We will conclude the seventh chapter of the book of Isaiah today, and I will read from verses 18 to 25, and then, as is our custom, we'll go over them individually or in sections. The text reads, Jehovah will bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. And it shall come to pass in that day that Jehovah will hiss for the fly that is in the uppermost parts of the rivers of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And they shall come and shall rest all of them in the desolate valleys and in the cliffs of the rocks and upon all thorn hedges and upon all pastures. In that day will the Lord shade with a razor that is hired in the parts of the river, even with the king of Assyria, the head, the hair of the feet, and it shall consume the beard. And it shall come to pass in that day that a man shall keep alive a young cow and two sheep. And it shall come to pass that because of the abundance of milk which they shall give, he shall eat butter. For butter and honey shall everyone eat that is left in the midst of the land. And it shall come to pass in that day that every place where there were 1,000 vines had 1,000 silver linings shall be for briars and thorns. With arrows and with bow shall one come thither, because all the land shall be briars and thorns, and all the hills that were digged with the mattock, thou shalt not come thither for fear of briars and thorns, but it shall be for ascending for the oxen and for the treading of sheep. Now, this is a very difficult passage to assimilate, and I'm hoping I can do it justice this morning because I'm going to explain it in a couple different ways here. The Lord is saying he's going to send the Egyptians and the Assyrians in judgment to Israel for their sins. And we're going to start with two verses first, verse 18 and 19, or 17 and to 19, excuse me. Jehovah will bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. And it shall come to pass in that day that Jehovah will hiss for the fly that is in the uppermost part of the rivers of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And they shall come and shall rest all of them in the desolate valleys and in the clefts of the rocks and upon the thorn hedges and upon all the pastures. Now, we saw in a previous chapter where God is talking about communicating to the bee as he's going to communicate to these armies to come in. He's going to send the communication as he would a bee to these armies to get them to come in. And he's not going to have to convince them to come in. They already want to do that because they're extremely aggressive and sinful people, and they're already motivated to do this. They just need that spark of information that there's the prey, go get it. That's all they need. You know, the nation Israel has been sandwiched in between Mesopotamia and Egypt and the armies there, the Egyptians represented by the rivers here, which is the rivers of the Nile Delta, and the Assyrians are in the Mesopotamian valleys on the east side of the Euphrates River. Each of these nations have wanted to conquer Israel at one time or another. Because God gave Israel his blessings in that Mosaic covenant that no one else had. No one had the prosperity, especially that culminated in Solomon. I mean, Solomon had, again, more money than anyone ever has had, ever. If you look at it in modern times, he vastly exceeds anybody. They had dietary laws, sanitary laws, social practices that the God of the universe, the Creator, gave them so that other nations would want what they had. And that's really the crux of this. These other nations wanted to take it away from them. They wanted to conquer Israel at one time or another for their own aggressive purposes. But now, what God's doing, he's communicating with them and telling them to do it for his purpose. No longer just these nations' normal aggressive behavior that want to go conquer everything that moves. This is now at God's leading, a leading for them. The time of this prophecy was about 735 B.C. And Egypt wasn't much of a threat at that particular time to the nation Israel. The Assyrians were. Now remember from our last session in the first part of this chapter, Ahaz worried about the Syrians, not the Assyrians, in the north, and the northern 10 tribes would be under Pekah, and the Syrians under Rezin were threatening an alliance to come down and attack the south. Now, they'd already done this before, and Ahaz didn't want it to happen again. So he goes to the Assyrians in the east and tries to make a deal with them to protect him. The worst thing he could have done, not relying on God and going to somebody that God is going to use to bring into him to attack him, to attack all of them. Egypt is not going to really come into play here for a number of years. There were some small skirmishes, border skirmishes, but really not until about 130 years later, in 607 or so B.C., did the Egyptians come in, and they were going to fight the Babylonians in the northern part of Israel at a battle called Carchemish. And that was an enormous battle. It's written up in the Encyclopedia Britannica and a number of other sources that really realigned the countries in the Middle East. And the Babylonians battled with the Egyptians, and the Jews went up to battle with them. That's where King Josiah lost his life. So that really is one of the bigger battles that the Egyptians had with the nation Israel. So it's a long ways away. Therefore, these prophecies here to those two nations are to be seen as separate events, not both nations coming against Israel at one time, because there isn't any historical reference to that in either the biblical text of the Kings and the Chronicles or secular history. The Lord makes it really clear, and this is very hard for most of us to assimilate, is he uses these sinful people, and they were extremely sinful, to correct, punish, if you will, his people for their sins. Because God will always punish sin. But he uses these sinful people to punish his people for their sins. Then he corrects or punishes the sinful people that he used. Now, this doesn't make sense to us because we're thinking, why don't you just wipe out the sin, period? That's not his plan. His plan is to do this through the Savior, which would come. And then the Savior is coming back to set up the millennial or messianic kingdom. So we have to keep that in mind, that God uses these sinful people, and then he corrects or judges the sinful people. And the Lord is making this really clear, that the events that are coming upon Israel after the 735 BC date of this prophecy is going to be bigger than anything has ever happened since the Civil War in 931 BC. So it was a couple hundred years earlier when the ten kingdoms broke off to the north. We're calling them Ephraim as a reference. You know, it's like we call us the United States or America or the States, if you will. And well, that ten-nation confederacy or ten-tribe confederacy has different names too. Ephraim, the northern ten tribes, and so on. And even called Israel, just those ten tribes. So it has never happened before, what's coming. And we're going to just look at a little bit of this because different chapters in Isaiah are going to go into this in a lot more detail. Because it is such a huge event, the Assyrians, which is the central focus of this passage, not so much the Egyptians, but he's going to use them too, but not as much as the Assyrians. To send Assyria and Egypt to Israel, he communicates through these insects. And when we were in chapter 5, we looked at the communication that bees have amongst each other for movement of where they're going to get pollen, when the queen's having problems, how they can come back. It's phenomenal, the studies that have been done on bee communication. It almost sounds fanciful if it wasn't so true. The beekeepers talk about this, that these bees can communicate with each other. And either the production of the honey, or the management of the hive, or the protection of the queen. And God is using these insects to communicate to the leaders of Israel, of Assyria and the leaders of Egypt. Now the prophet's saying here that at the appropriate time from this prophecy in 735, he's going to send the Assyrians and the Egyptians to invade Israel. Now, the Lord is going to hiss in a manner that these insects and the invading army will understand. And they'll stop what they're doing and say, oh, time to invade Israel. They're just going to know this. And by means of hissing, you know, it's a language that they're going to understand. Jehovah God is saying that these distant nations are going to come, as he said in the fifth chapter. He didn't identify those nations in the text of the fifth chapter. We did. I mentioned that they would be the Assyrians. Well, now he's reiterating this in a little more detail, but he's identifying the nations, specifically the Egyptians and the Assyrians, which are two huge rivals to Israel. And the interesting thing that I see here is that he's using these insects to communicate with them. They also have some imagery to reference these two nations. The Egyptians are compared to swarms of venomous flies that live in the region of the Nile Delta, and the Assyrians are the bees, which are kind of native to their woods and mountains. And the characteristics of these are interesting too, because God uses these items and agricultural items to provide an illustration of the characteristics of the individuals that he's talking about here. Egyptians are compared to a fly, Syrians to a bee. And this implies that the fly is weaker than the bee, because the bees can sting, and they're stronger and they're larger. Egyptian were militarily weaker in numbers and strength than the Assyrians. And he's also drawing a comparison to invading insects that come in clouds. You probably heard of the locust clouds that come at different times. We've had them not here in Michigan that I'm aware of, but in Iowa and in the central plains, where they come like clouds and they just devour all the agriculture. Now, this has happened a number of times. Well, that's the imagery here, that these armies are going to come just like a cloud of insects, blotting out the sun, covering everything and going everywhere and blackening the sky. They're going to swarm in and they're going to suffocate and consume everything in their path. He's trying to describe the invasion is going to be something that the Israelis cannot stop. They can't negotiate. They can't stop it. Even though Ahaz is trying to make a deal with these bad guys, God's saying, I'm going to send them. I'm going to send them, and you can't stop it. This is going to be like one surge after another. They're going to come in great numbers, and they're going to occupy the whole country. The Lord is using this as a scourge, if you will, a corrective device for the sins of the people. And when we were in the book of Ezekiel, we cited some of the sins before the Babylonians came in. These were heinous sins. It wasn't a casual sin. I mean, these folks were into idolatry and sexual immorality, and they had embraced the drug culture from the surrounding Canaanite population. When this invasion happens, it's going to include the steep ravines, the clefts of the rocks, upon all thorn hedges and upon all pastures. And God's saying, hey, these guys are coming in everywhere. There isn't going to be any place that they're not going to get. In other words, Israel's going to be completely overrun. And again, they can't stop it. There's nothing that they can stop it. And as we've looked at in the past, the Hebrew language, in the verbal system, there's only two tenses, completed tense and incomplete tense. Now, these are prophecies that are written in the completed tense. So it's as if God's saying, it's already done. It's already done in his mind. It's completed in heaven, the decision, that is, the action. But in time and space, it hasn't happened yet. But as far as he's concerned, it's not going to change. It's going to happen. They're going to be, I mean, these armies are going to come into every city, town, and villages with one exception, and we'll look at that in a few moments. They're going to be everywhere. There isn't any place to hide. What follows is two, that I'm going to bring out here, two different views of this, and both of them are defendable, and I'm going to give you the information that's available to look at both of these views of these invasions. One favors the general context of the entire chapter 7. And the other favors just verse 20, because verse 20 that we're going to look at here makes a big departure in the Hebrew text from the context. In 722, it's only 13 years after this prophecy, the Assyrians came in to the northern 10 tribes. They devastated it. They devastated it. They came in. They conducted a scourge of the people. They killed thousands. They carted off thousands back to the Babylonian area. In Mesopotamia, their capital was Nineveh, and they took them back there. And they brought in people from other people groups in Mesopotamia and replanted them there. And the purpose in general for them doing this is so the nations would be bred with these people that they're bringing in, and therefore they wouldn't have the motivation to rise up against the Assyrians. In other words, once you're conquered, we're going to make sure you stay conquered. It's a different way that the Romans did it. The Romans implemented imperialism. and did it differently. But the Assyrians didn't do that. That process was developed by the Romans. So they didn't have that yet. So their idea was, we go in, take the people out, take them back to our country, use them as forced labor, if you will, and then take people from the surrounding areas in Mesopotamia and take them back there, have them marry into the people that are there, produce a new race of people, and that became the Samaritans, which were half-breeds. And at the time of Jesus, the Jews hated the Samaritans, just hated them. And the reason was that they were half-breeds, and the Jews are remembering what happened with the Assyrians, and they didn't like it. So they didn't like those people either. Well, the picture here that is formed is that they come in 722 B.C. They're so puffed up with this victory that they decide, we're going to go down in the south too. I mean, we did so good here, let's go down in the south. Let's go get Judah. They come down into Judah, and I think they get about 10 cities. And then they try and go to Jerusalem, and everything changed when they tried to go to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is God's apple. It's His prize. It's His city. Nobody is going to harm Jerusalem until He brings it upon them. And that's going to be in the last stage of the campaign of Armageddon, just before the millennial kingdom gets set up. Well, let's look at this chapter 7, verse 20, and then we'll look at it in these two different ways, and I'll tell you who's saying these things. In that day will the Lord shave with a razor that is hired in the parts beyond the river, even with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it shall also consume the beard. Now, these opinions are divided up between Jews and Gentiles. It's just that simple. All of the conservative Gentile scholars view it this way, that the Assyrians are like a barber, and they're going to humiliate the Israelite by cutting their hair off and cutting their vegetation off, shaving the land, if you will. And it's imagery here that is consistent with what was done in Israel, specifically at the time of David, where we see it happening, how you humiliate your prisoners of war. You shave the hair off their head. You shave their beards off. And that's worse even. I mean, it just humiliates them. And it's saying here, God's going to use foreigners on the other side of the Euphrates River. That's the Assyrians. That's where they live. And He's going to accomplish this regardless of the deal that Ahaz tried to make with these folks. He thought he was hiring them to deliver him from this alliance up in the north between Pekah and Rezin, northern ten tribe Pekah, Rezin, the leader in Syria. And he was vastly mistaken, because he should have trusted God, and he didn't trust God. The practice, though, of cutting off one's beard and hair was a degrading practice. I mean, it was designed to humiliate. You know, you see this happening at the end of the Second World War in France, where women that had collaborated with the German soldiers, were they shaved their heads and they pushed them out in public and kept them there to humiliate them. It's a humiliating experience. Look at what happened with David, 2 Samuel 10, verses 1 to 7. And it came to pass after that, the king of the children of Ammon died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his stead. Now, Ammon was over on the east side of the Jordan River. And David said, I will show kindness unto Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness unto me. So David sent by his servants to comfort him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the children of Ammon But the princes of the children of Ammon said to Hanun, their lord, "Thinkest thou that David doth honor thy father, and that he has sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David sent his servants unto thee to search the city and spy it out and to overthrow it?" So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off one half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle, even to the buttocks, and sent them away. When they told it unto David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, "Tarry at Jericho until your beards be grown, and then return." In other words, get out of the public view to lessen your humiliation, your shame. Because that's what it was. That's what it was. And when the children of Ammon saw that they were become odious to David, the children of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth-Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 footmen, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. So this was so humiliating that it was producing a war. So, you know, we wouldn't see it that way in this culture. In that culture at that time, this reference to cutting off the hair is a serious humiliation. Complete. All the hair of the body in this text is saying it's going to be shorn off. So the badge of respect at that time was the beard in the men. And humanly speaking, Judah's going to have no honor left. The men will have no honor. The land's going to be desolate as well. It's going to, you know, it could be referencing the shaving of the land or the shaving of the beards of the people, both of which are going to provide a massive amount of humiliation here. And that's what Jehovah God here is doing. He's humiliating them for the sins that they committed against him. The general agreement of the Jewish commentators, and then again, this is a big difference between these two, and I agree with this, of just this one verse is describing what the Lord is going to be doing to the Assyrian king. Not using the Assyrian king to do this to the Jews, but using this process of humiliating the Assyrian king. And there's good support for that. The general agreement of all the Jewish commentators, and I'll tell you, I didn't find any of the Jewish commentators with the Gentile view of this. The Gentile view is the whole passage, the whole series of passages in chapter 7, all refer to the Syrians being used to judge Israel. And that is true except for the fact that God judges sin, even those that he's used to judge his people, sinful people. And we're going to look here at what happened when the Assyrians tried to go into Jerusalem. Now remember now, 722 B.C., they sack the northern 10 tribes and completely devour it. By the time they get down in the south and they're conquering city after city, then they get over to Jerusalem. It's now 701 B.C., 21 years later. So the Assyrian army gets miraculously destroyed trying to attack Jerusalem. There's a good king now, Hezekiah. Matter of fact, he, in the Hebrew text here, could rival David. You know, David is viewed in general as the greatest of the kings. The text says that there's never been a king before like Hezekiah, never one after like him. So, in 701, Sennacherib, the general, king, whatever, the emperor there, is struck down by a plague. So the Jewish commentators see the head and the hair of the feet and consuming the beard as representing the king, the head, the soldiers, the hair of the feet, and the officials, the beard. Now, Sennacherib himself survived this plague, but when he got back to Nineveh, he was assassinated by his sons. So even he got wiped out. Even he got wiped out. Let's look at the passage here in 2 Kings about this. And we're going to go into this in much greater detail in later chapters of Isaiah, because this is going to get brought out in a lot more detail. Therefore, thus saith Jehovah concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there. Neither shall he come before it with shield, nor cast up a mound against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return. And he shall not come into this city, saith Jehovah, for I will defend this city to save it, for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. And it came to pass that night that the angel of Jehovah went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. That's 185,000. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Shazir smote him with the sword, and they escaped in the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. Now you think about this. God stops 185,000 troops, kills them, that were going to attack his city. And that seems to be the best, I would say, way to look at verse 20 here. Not that God is using this in this passage only. I'm not talking about the general concept. I mean, it's real obvious what God did with the Assyrians to correct the Jews in the north and even the 10 cities around Jerusalem, but not Jerusalem. That is not going to happen. So after the destruction of the Assyrians at Jerusalem, the text in Isaiah moves on. And it shall come to pass in that day that a man shall keep alive a young cow and two sheep. And it shall come to pass that because of the abundance of milk which they shall give, he shall eat butter. For butter and honey shall everyone eat that is in the midst of the land. Because of the diverse opinions about the use of the Assyrians, and whether we're talking about the Jerusalem victory, if you will, of the Jews, that God did not let the Assyrians get into Jerusalem, there's two views on this, too. They're pretty close to each other. In the days of Hezekiah, around Jerusalem, after the destruction of Sennacherib's army, there was a lot of blessings and plenty. And we're going to see that in the 37th chapter. That's why I don't want to go into it in great detail today, because this gets acted out and described in greater detail about how God did these things, why God did these things. Because at this time, right after the saving of Jerusalem, Judah gets a miraculous prosperity. God's going to bless their possessions so that only a few animals are sufficient to support a person or a family. And the limited number of animals needed to produce a lot are what gives the people a lot to eat and drink. He's saying just these few animals are going to support y'all. You know, and he's using this example of milk that's going to produce rich cream where they can drink and eat the fruit of the fat of the milk, the cream, and discard the whey, the watery part. Honey's going to be very in abundance, and it's going to make the land seem to flow with milk and honey as God promised in Deuteronomy 31. If they didn't sin, it was conditional. Deuteronomy 31:20 says, "For when I shall have brought them into the land which I swear unto their fathers, flowing with milk and honey, and they shall have eaten and filled themselves and waxed fat, then will they turn unto other gods and serve them and despise me and break my covenant." But not at the time of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a righteous man. Here's the other view. Because the general discussion is that the Assyrians are invading, possible that these passages just refer to the fact that there's only going to be a few people left in Judah in the south, and there's going to be a scarcity of men and cattle. So they're not going to have any large flocks or large herds, only a single cow and two or three sheep, and the reduced population is all they're going to need. Because there's not going to be very many people there. So these small measures of food that are needed will be able to be produced by a few animals. The cow and the two sheep, they're going to have large pastures because there's not going to be very many people after the Assyrians wipe out a big part of the population. And the owner of these are going to be able to make butter out of the milk because there's going to be an abundance of these things because there's not very many people to consume them. And this just looks at this in a little different way from the entire context, which is way, interestingly enough, the Gentiles look at it. The Jews look at it differently from the fact that Jerusalem was spared. And they're talking about Jerusalem being spared. And it is true that during the time of Hezekiah, there was prosperity and abundance. So that's the different views of this, these passages. And I tend to favor the Jewish view of it because it is true that the Assyrians could not get to Jerusalem. And that's the capital. That's where the abundance is. And the times of Hezekiah were very, very good. Very, very good. Now, let's look at the destruction of the land here. God is saying, verses 23 to 25, "And it shall come to pass in that day that every place where there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silverlings," that's the cost, price, value, "shall be for briars and thorns. With arrows and with bow shall one come thither, because all the land shall be briars and thorns, and all the hills that were digged with the mattock or a hoe, thou shalt not come thither for fear of briars and thorns, but it shall be for the sending forth of oxen and for the treading of sheep." Now, the armies are going to completely wipe out the north, and they're going to get a substantial part of the south in 701 B.C., not Jerusalem or the environs there. So this is not obviously describing what Sennacherib was able to do in Jerusalem, which is zero. It's obviously describing the property that he could get to, and he did change. The devastation of the land is even going to include the fertile vines. And if we remember back to chapter 5, of the parable of the vineyard, God said, "I planted a vineyard, and I planted these wonderful grapes, vines, and it brought forth these terrible vines that produced terrible grapes." He's using this as imagery of the vineyard and what he did, leaving himself in the midst of the vineyard, and the people didn't want it. People didn't want it. They turned against him. Now, he's saying here, the people are going to abandon these areas because the armies have just wiped out all the produce, wiped out the vines. And the vines had great value, but they're not there anymore because the armies wiped them out. And so these people just abandon this region and it becomes filled with wild animals, just like the prophecy with the imagery of the vineyard from chapter 5. The whole area is going to be unsafe except for people with armaments. that can go in there. You're going to have some ne'er-do-well people, but you're going to have these big wild animals too. So they got to protect themselves. Those are the only people that are going to want to be there. If you got the bows they're talking about, bow and arrow, the land is going to be unproductive to farm. It was once carefully cultivated. No one will enter. And the sheep and the oxen are going to trample anything that's there looking for food. That's the destruction that God is bringing on most of the whole nation of Israel. And he's using primarily the Assyrians, because again, the Egyptians are not going to have anything like that going against Israel for nearly 100 years. So a complete change has taken place. The places that were once cultivated by men are now the trampling and grazing grounds, if you will, for the oxen and the sheep. The vineyard that the Lord planted has gone sour, so he's brought in the animals to graze there, to trample everything. The invading foe was successful. The hired razor has shaved clean. The land is desolate. Men are gone. And oxen and grazing sheep remain in what had been property owned by the Jews as high value and very productive. Let's pray.